You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to Post Show Recap's coverage of Obi-Wan Kenobi. My name is Mike Bloom here to talk about episode Obi-3 Kenobi. I guess I'm going to start using that pun-based method of ordering as we get into a literal incendiary episode. We're at the halfway point, but my God, what an act one closer as we take a bit of an intermission. We've had 3 episodes in 5 days. Now we take a bit of a break and things are in dire condition. So I'm very excited to break down this episode. First, with a guy who has been doing more digging around the internet than a mole person alien voiced by Zach Braff, the great DM Philly. Rich, how you doing?
Hello there. I'm so good. I'm so glad I'm not trapped under the sands of Tatooine anymore. The mole people are free, Mike.
Yeah, but they're kind of, I don't know, frickin' Freck. We're going to get into frickin' Freck later on. He's a little bit of a...
The mole people are also fascists, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they should stay under the hill, is all I'm saying, and go nowhere near another type of hill. Well, I am very excited to bring in someone who will certainly speak her mind, unlike any serving droids that might be in any automotive shops. The great LaTanya Starks. LaTanya, how are you doing?
Hello there. So we were wrong about everything.
Yay.
That's amazing. Yeah. I think you need to, as avid television watchers, I love reveling in the fact that we were wrong about it in a good way. It's not, oh my God, we were wrong and they should have done this. I will say I largely enjoyed this episode and specifically the fact that everything we were saying, to your point, LT, when is Vader going to come into contact with Obi-Wan? When is Obi-Wan going to release his lightsaber? We're saying like episode 5, episode 6, maybe not even in the series. And we got both in episode 3. That is wild to me.
It's pretty cool. I was just all about this episode. I think I had reminders in my phone because it was kind of a wonky week with us getting Monday off. And I was like, oh, tomorrow is Wednesday. That's not true. That would have been terrible for this podcast. it was just the visuals in this episode were from top to bottom amazing, and I'm very excited to talk about it.
Yeah, Rich, what were your overall thoughts about this episode? Considering how pumped you were about episodes 1 and 2, I can only imagine it got increased to the heat level of the fires of Mustafar.
gosh, I'm a little all over the place. It's still so soon. I'm trying to like process it. I'm really happy. I'm loving that there's an Obi-Wan show. It's so cool. So much of it was so good. I think to LT's point, like visually, it was stunning. It was like a really powerful, scary, evocative episode that was like additive in all those good ways. And to the point of like all the things we were wrong about, I'm still trying to reconcile how I feel about that, baby. Like, but I'm pretty pleased. It was good. I'm very excited for next episode, and I'm very excited to talk about this one.
All right, so that being said, if you want to hear us talk about this episode, as well as the next episode that Rich is talking about, as well as the previous episodes, if you just happen to stumble across this, like Darth Vader slowly parading down a village street, please do not choke us, but subscribe to us. PostShowRecaps.com/Star Wars. That's where you get our coverage of all things Star Wars out there in the universe. And any ratings and reviews that are left are, of course, greatly appreciated. So, yeah, I mean, it's a big episode in many ways. And again, I would say when we saw the glimpse of Anakin Skywalker in the back to tank at the end of episode 2, I thought that was going to be like a nice microcosm of what we would see of him for so long, right? Of just like glimpses of he's coming, he'll eventually get out of the tank, and then he's on his way. And the fact that we started the episode with him coming out of the tank was a nice representation of the fact of, okay, we indeed see the majesty and the threat. We talk about with a lot of these shows the idea of, oh, it's the 6-hour movie, you know, of how it might be plotted out specifically when it comes to the Marvel stuff. This very much felt to me like your act 2 climax, right? They call it, I think, like all hope is lost when it comes to the hero's journey of, okay, you know, the bad guy has taken over, defeated the hero, albeit temporarily. Any sort of like MacGuffin has now been taken off the board. It seems like everything is done and dusted and hope is out of sight. Obviously, that is not the case. And I think Obi-Wan will prevail to a certain extent. But I'll ask you, LaTanya, I know I don't want to start at the end because I want to go, you know, through this episode proper. But what was your reaction to where this episode left us with only 3 episodes to go? But I use only as kind of an operative term, considering how much has already happened in the first 3 episodes.
I actually really like the ending. Normally, I can get annoyed by having a week-to-week show that has that kind of, oh no, what's going to happen next? Cliffhanger ending, only because I want to know what's going to happen next, not because I'm not enjoying the content or what's happening. I think that with us, you know, these are really hopeless moments that we are looking at. And that's something that, you know, ultimately Star Wars is always kind of the characters are the phoenixes that rise from the ashes. This is the, like the ash point, you know, literally Obi-Wan has been dragged across a desert of fire and is, you know, just barely rescued by a character that I'm really excited to talk about later. But then I knew they just in the closed captioning had that a voice was talking to Leia, but I knew that that was Reva's voice. So the idea of kind of we didn't get Obi-Wan maybe during this particular time, but we got bait, the same bait that we've been using, granted, from the first episode on. But, you know, the bond that he has with her, with this child now, is so much more cemented than it was before that no matter what he's going to have to go through to heal or to get to her, he's going to get to her. So I really like the idea of separating these two characters and kind of making everything seem perilous for a while.
It's a good question, Rich. How do we define a while? Again, I don't want to do too much prognosticating considering we have an entire whole last episode to get through, but to the point that it leaves it, you know, Mando and Grogu, infamously, when they get separated, they only get separated for like a couple of episodes, it seems. Do you think we're getting the same thing here with Obi-Wan and young Leia?
Yes. Yeah, I would imagine that they're reunited by the end of episode 4, by the end of next time. I'm so bad with like conjecture and projection of like guessing where this is going to go. I have like my expectations about where we're evolving, but I think like what LT's saying is spot on, right? The bond is like so much stronger. I think like so much of what episode 2 was is like Leia poking at Obi-Wan and prodding at him and digging at him and kind of needling him. And this one is Obi-Wan reconciling like, oh God, God, I'm in this position. You know, I'm here with like Padme's daughter, with Anakin's daughter, all the like kind of back and forth between them on the barge. I think there's so many like poignant, lovely little moments that really like articulate that bond. I'm very curious to see how it drives him forward. But I said it last time, but it's the ultimate motivator for Obi-Wan to like get him up and out. So much of what I talked about in the previews, my excitement at like looking at this man in his broken state, trying to like reconcile all this failure that he's got like weighing him down. And we're seeing it now, and I'm really digging it, you know. And this is yet another failure in the midst of like the show that we're watching, of like, oh yeah, you had one job, Obi-Wan, you know. And I think there's a lot of like juice there narratively to explore, right?
Just don't get him involved with youths. I think that's the problem, is Obi-Wan's like, I'm good with my peers. It's whenever I have to take care of someone, the younger they get them, the worse off they get. Though maybe Anakin was maybe a bit of an exception, considering that Leia is not going near the dark side, at least at this point. I mean, speaking of the past, I did find a really nice, interesting use of obviously all that previous VO stuff from, you know, the Jedi Masters and even Anakin, right? When you have the ability to look inside Obi-Wan's thoughts without even being a Jedi, and hearing essentially like the words that are echoing through his head as he calls out to Qui-Gon Jinn. Though maybe it was just because Leia kept asking, are we there yet? And he's just like, get her away from me. I'm done with this. I don't want to play punch buggy anymore. Damn it.
Everyone knows, first of all, Mike, it's pronounced Utes. second of all, there's a lot of really cool rhymes in this episode that kind of like go along with that. There's the idea of, you know, Obi-Wan having to kind of like sire yet another kid of Anakin's. There's the idea of trying to commune with, you know, his teacher in terms of like force presence, and kind of like the mirage, I guess, that he sees in the desert later of Anakin. I just really think that this episode has a lot of great beats. My favorite of the season so far.
Yeah. Rich, what did you think about, you know, the use of this? Does this, you know, serve as the breadcrumbs that are leading us to this eventual contact of someone like a Qui-Gon Jinn, who, again, Obi-Wan was instructed to learn from, and he has yet to do so in his time on Tatooine?
I love how we talked about it a lot in the preview, but I love how focused we are on this theme. Like, we are not overlooking the fact that Obi-Wan has got some like real emotional blocks. Like, he cannot achieve this skill that like Yoda left him to train with over the course of the last 10 years. Presumably he's been sitting in that cave for 10 years, like calling out for this man for guidance, right? In this role where like he's being tasked with like, you need to raise this child, and then he fails, he's like calling to his master, to his father. And I think that when we get like so much reflection on Obi-Wan's past, we've never heard him like talk this explicitly about where he comes from before. I remember, you know, a bit of my mother's veil, my father's hands. Dude, this is sad stuff. This is really heavy, right? And as he's now looking at the face of this girl that he's telling us, I could see your mother's face, he can literally see her father standing in the desert where he's got this incredible weight bear gun on him. And fundamentally, like, what is he doing? He's pleading for like his father, right? For his leader, for his mentor, to give him guidance. And there's so much strength in that. I've been podcasting about Under the Banner of Heaven with Grace Leader, very different kind of show, as we're
great
diving
show.
Into it's a great show, but we're diving into the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon religion. It's an exploration of faith in a lot of ways. This is religious, right? I mean, there's a religious like connotation to this. There always have been to the Jedi, that old religion, that old sorcery, right? And so as we see this man calling out in a way that you would in a faithful person to their God, this man calling to his teacher, to his mentor, to his patriarch, to fundamentally like the person who filled the role as his father, God, it's tragic. And Ben's so like powerful that like we have to be building to like something here. I hope that like he gets something at the end of this, right?
He mentions a baby. I just want to put, there's a Kenobi baby somewhere out there.
So it's interesting because from a now proven non-canonical perspective, in another universe, I should say, Uncle Owen was speculated to be Obi-Wan Kenobi's brother. So now it seems like they're bringing a brother back in. That's not Owen Lars in this universe, at least. Though it is interesting that now if you look at like the Joel Edgerton, Ewan McGregor scenes in like a very different light and very brotherly bickering with each other. But yeah, I have to imagine, could there be a scene in the future where he goes like, you killed my brother. No, Obi-Wan, I am your brother. And then it just comes full circle.
Oh, no, Mike. Mind blown. I can't process this information.
That is one wild possibility.
Somehow Palpatine was an Obi-Wan.
Oh no, I am your brother, Obi-Wan. I was a baby, but it was just because I looked really old at the time.
Oh, Palpy.
I really loved that detail. I will say in general, Obi-Wan's attitude during their time on Mapuzo was, he was a little poo-poo on Mapuzo initially, right? When, you know, Leia's like, oh, you know, this is great. We're having a fun time. And he's like, well, no, people are all bad. Well, that stupid Haja tricked us. Like, he's such a Debbie Downer throughout the beginning. And again, I understand why, right? He, once again, much like with Anakin, is sort of like saddled with this responsibility. He didn't exactly sign up for this. He just wants to get her back home. But then he does warm up to it, either warm up or like maybe crack a bit under the pressure. I mean, Rich, you bring up this moment, right, where he talks about, like you said, the very loaded comment of like, oh, you look just like your mother. And then, you know, when he sees Anakin, this is right after he talked about her father. Of course, he to her is meaning Bail Organa, but obviously the specter of his father is existing right there. So it might just be an opportunity for Obi-Wan to be like, things are kind of falling apart for me. Why keep up the guise at this point? Why keep the metaphoric Jedi-hood up? Raise my head, talk a bit about this very tragic, very dark past, right? Of being snatched from his home to go become a devoted member of the Jedi Temple without really getting any sort of memory of his family. I just think it's a beautiful way to both examine the character, but not in a Hughes expository way of like, let's do a flashback on Obi-Wan. I wouldn't have been mad at it, Rich, but I think that less is more when it comes to these types of things.
I absolutely do. I mean, that's, I think, part of like maybe my take on the whole episode, that I'm not sure where I lie yet, because I think sometimes less is more. We talked so much about like, when is the lightsaber going to come out? When are the duels going to appear? But this not being this big winding kind of monologue of exposition about my family, it's very subtle, it's very small, but it's really powerful. And I think it like lends a lot of weight, especially, you know, when we exist in this era where we're looking back at Star Wars and what it's been for the last 40 years. Years in the real world, in our culture, and then internally, right, as we're now like examining like, okay, so what does it mean that like all these Jedi got rounded up as little kids? Like, this is a really dark idea that they like came and rounded this kid up and took him away from his family to like train him as part of like a cult of religious zealots. Like, is that what the Jedi are? Kind of, right? So there's just a lot of interesting stuff to explore here, and I loved like how subtle and understated it was.
Now, that being said, LaTanya, I think Obi-Wan has been relying a bit too much on the Jedi mind tricks in the intervening years, because dude rolled like a nat one on his deception check when it came to like, I literally had in my notes like, oh, Obi-Wan, you idiot. It was a facepalm moment, right? When he's sitting in the little bed of the truck and accidentally calls Leia the wrong name.
Yeah, her name is Luma. If the child can keep up, if Little Bird Box can keep up, then you should be able to do, Obi-Wan. But for me, this is all very largely indicative of just how in his head Reva got when, you know, we talked about this a little bit on Friday, when she said Anakin Skywalker is still alive, like Darth Vader is alive, and he can't really think of anything else. He's so distracted. When it comes to someone who we've seen be so cool and calm and like be able to develop and keep up with a backstory easily, he's the one that falters. And then he has to add a bit of a truth to the lie to, you know, tell these people, these stormtroopers, to be able to get out of this situation alive. So it you know, it's just very interesting how, and I'm looking forward to whatever the backstory is going to be between Obi-Wan and Reva, but it's just so interesting how insidious this character has managed to be by merely taunting him and telling him one line of truth.
I think it's notable Obi-Wan not great with fake names either, right, Mike? I mean, is that a thing? Maybe like the name is not.
Could it have been? I mean, when he does tell Tala before, like, it's Ben now, is it just because he screwed up so much with the fake name before? It's like, I gotta keep my story straight.
Yeah, he's
my name is
simple.
Ben.
Even Leia Luma, he's gotta keep them real close, you know? We got it.
Even if you call me Obi-Wan, my name is Ben. That's the role I'm playing right now. It's a really great point, LT, about, like, you know, Reva living credit free in his head at this point. I don't know if it even speaks to the relationship. I would not be surprised if he didn't know who she was, but she knew who was, which we can certainly get into. But I think more so it's just this idea of, to this point, like, Bail Organa said, that's in the past with Anakin Skywalker. Embrace the present. Look after Luke. Look after Leia, especially. So what happens when that past becomes your present is a very fun question that exists here. That's really, like, present throughout all of Star Wars, right? How does Luke deal with the fact that he thought his father was dead, but now his father is his greatest enemy? That's just been so key to everything going on with Star Wars. That's why they resurrect so many dead characters, is to really prove that theme. And I loved your point, LT, about, you know, he does sort of cover for the oopsie by saying, oh, you know, I get lost sometimes. But again, that is kind of where he's at from a mental perspective as well, that he is kind of displaced in time, in a manner of speaking. So we mentioned Reva. Let's talk about, like, the other side of this metaphoric force dyad of plot in the form of the Darth Vader of it all, at least in the beginning here. Like, we get the HQ on Mustafar. We do find out that it seems like he is liaising directly with Reva. So let's talk about the man himself, Rich, because obviously there was a big to-do about Hayden Christensen. Now, that being said, we did not hear Hayden Christensen in this episode, but at least from, like, a physical and a vocal perspective, how did it feel to have Darth Vader back in a major capacity? Like, I don't even know if we can count Rogue One. I would say since Revenge of the Sith.
I'm with you. People were so excited about the Darth Vader reveal at the end of Rogue One. And it's great. It's a really powerful scene. But I didn't get as swept up in it because it's so small. It's just a final beat and it's kind of a foregone conclusion. It's an awesome setup to, like, sit down and watch Rogue One right into Force, A New Hope, rather. It's like so much fun to make that jump. But as a scene, like, it didn't carry the weight for me that it did for a lot of other folks. This did. This, like, armoring of Vader, the, like, no limbs, the looking at, like, this desiccated body as, like, bionic parts are being plugged into him. Your father is more machine than man now. Like, it's all, like, so right there. The whole castle on Mustafar, like, this is all perfect. It is just, like, pitch perfect. Visually, the tone, the weight, the pacing of all of it as he comes, like, stalking out of the smoke and the black and the red light. Like, I mean, it's right there, right? Chills. Like, I'm so kind of caught up and overwhelmed by this initial rollout of Vader that I just was, like, completely swept up in the moment. I'm not, like, the biggest of Darth Vader fans. I say this, I guess, with, like, a grain of salt. I love Darth Vader. I adore Star Wars. But I know for some people, like, Vader is the end-all be-all of Star Wars, right? He's, like, the top of the pyramid. He's their favorite. And to me, like, he's great, but he served his place. He's got his role. And, like, how we use him now has to be, like, smart. So I loved this. And I like, love a lot of, like, what happens with Vader throughout the rest of the episode. It's terrifying, Mike.
Yeah, what did you think about all that, LT? I guess we'll start with, you know, like you said, the getting ready montage. He's just getting his face on.
Oh, yeah. You know, like every good 90s movie, he's just trying on outfits.
Yeah, and you have, what? You know, Moff Tarkin being like, mm-mm-mm, shaking his head.
Not
like,
that one.
Wrong outfit on.
Nope, wrong arm. No, so the thing that really struck me during this whole getting ready was kind of a bit of the pomp and circumstance of it. You know, like you would have a king would have a dresser, you know, and there's essentially an electronic one that's doing this, like droids are doing all of this. But what really got to me was just how much pain, like chronic, terrible pain this person has to be in at all times. He's basically just middle and ahead. He doesn't have arms. He doesn't have legs. We see this like giant chest plate get plugged into him. It's all very visceral. And then we kind of, you know, get the cover finally and the iconic breathing, which sounds strained and terrible as well. I mean, you can imagine that from just the pain that he has to suffer on a daily basis, that would be enough. As someone who suffers from chronic pain, that would be enough to turn me to the dark side for sure. Would I spend 10 years obsessing over the person, place, or thing that made me this? Oh, hell yeah. And I would, for it, like in a minute, the second I heard that they have been located, I'd be like, let's go. It's time.
Yeah, exactly. Just need to go see an acupuncturist, and that will avoid you going over to the dark side, perhaps. I mean, I totally agree with what both of you said. God, the atmosphere was so good. Not just the atmosphere on Mustafar, which is probably very heated, but I love it. I know that we saw it a bit at the end of Revenge of the Sith, right, with the actual formation, but that was a bit undone by the no of it all. So to actually see, like, that stupidity, for lack of a better term, taken away was really great. And even just this idea of, to your point, like, while he is probably living in agony each and every day, it's just this idea of revenge and fascism that is keeping his gears going, in a manner of speaking. He tells Reva, right, like, Grand Inquisitor doesn't matter, he'll show up in another series. Kenobi is the one that matters, and we see why later on. Like, good God, when he sees Obi-Wan Kenobi for that brief encounter in episode 4, which we will certainly get into in this episode with its implications, it seems like, you know, they're not exactly pleasant to one another, but I did not necessarily feel any source of, like, I don't know, vehement hatred towards each other or in one direction. And here, Vader's like, no, roast my little piggy. I want you to roast like the way you roasted me. It's freaking vindictive, and it is torturous. And I gotta say, like, it's really fun.
It's cool as hell, right?
It's incredible.
It's cool.
Yeah.
I love Darth Vader, personally. I'm a basic bitch in that regard. You know, he was number 2 in the EW Star Wars character rankings. He's probably my number 1, because I think, especially rewatching the prequels, like, I do appreciate the journey of Anakin Skywalker, maybe not the writing. And Darth Vader as a villain, like, Dalton Ross opened my eyes to this. He probably is the most iconic villain of all time.
I think so. I think that's easy. Yeah.
Yeah, like, from a literal perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the helmet, the breathing, to your point, LT, it's all associated with this guy that has spanned decades and, you know, planets, perhaps. And so to actually, like, see him walk around, I thought was done effectively well. I do feel kind of bad for Hayden Christensen, because, like, he essentially was a body double this entire time. But, like, I can't be mad to have James Earl Jones back as well. So, like you said, Rich, it's a complicated emotion.
The whole Hayden Christensen thing, like, right off the rip, when they're like, we're bringing back Hayden Christensen as Darth Vader, it was a little bit like,
but why though?
So, like, you know, if we do, this is why I thought, like, we would trade a little bit more on flashbacks. Like, I think that they would want more of him without the mask, right? This is like a problem that modern Star Wars faces, as we're gonna, like, introduce these awesome characters like a Kylo Ren, like a Reva. We're like, we'd love to put them in a badass mask, but we also really want to see their face. You're like, we want you to know who it is. It really was, like, very evocative. And to your point, LT, of, like, the pain that he's feeling, it's so palpable, right? The, like, agony, the slow, like, grueling process, the pomp, the royalty of all of it. And as you go back to that duel in episode 4 in A New Hope, right? They're like samurai as they meet, right? They're both very measured and controlled. There is this, like, presentation of kind of meticulousness, right? They have this, like, this facade of this wall up between each other. And I think the longer Star Wars has existed and figured out what it is, we've, like, really bought into this. Like, so much of what the Sith ideology is about is, like, feeding into your emotions, feeding into the anger, the hate, all of it. And yeah, you could tell how, like, this guy had excruciating pain is, like, really bad. He's really bad, you know.
So let's get into a little bit of stuff going on with Darth Vader. First, as I mentioned before, he is, you know, hollowing with Reva, and it does seem, indeed, her claims of, like, oh, I know he's alive, it seems like she is liaising directly with him. You know, a little complicated, because we get Captain Whisper, the fifth brother, right? Like, he's also talking with Darth Vader. Latanya, do we think we have any sort of further evidence of the myth of Reva based on what we found out from this episode, specifically her interactions with Darth Vader?
So there are a few things and a theory. The first is that it obviously makes the most sense, you all's theory last week, that as the first youngling that we see in the first shot of the show is like a young Black girl, that could and most likely is Reva. It makes sense from a story perspective. I just personally don't like to think that every Black person on the screen is the same person.
From
a story perspective, it makes total sense. You can see this going a couple different ways. You can see her. Well, first of all, it would make sense that if she was one of the younglings that was training, because most people don't know that Anakin, maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't think that most people know that Anakin and Darth Vader are the same person.
No. So, yeah, Palpy put like a nice kibosh on that. He does not want anyone to know it.
Yeah, so for her to have already had that backstory when she told Obi-Wan, you know, when they were first meeting and she was doing the Warriors Come Out to Play thing, that, you know, Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader is still alive. She has to have some reason to have that knowledge. And maybe that's because she looked up to both of them mm-hmm. when she was training, and felt that Obi-Wan did not protect her in the end. Or it could also be, this is like my theory, that because a lot of these characters that we see that are presented as evil end up redeeming themselves. I mean, obviously the biggest one is Darth Vader himself. And it could be that she's like a double agent, that she's decided to go the way of the Sith for now so that she can get close enough to Darth Vader to take him out, because she knows that he was instrumental in Order 66. So I'm really interested in seeing what happens.
I love that vibe. That's a really interesting take, LT, because I talk a lot about like the other Star Wars that exist out there. There've been like so many video games and novels and all this like extended stuff over the decades. And in a lot of the video games in particular, Knights of the Old Republic and the Old Republic MMO, there's all this exploration of dark side Jedi, light side Sith, of like walking that kind of middle balance of the ways that outside of like the main film canon, you can have different kind of ideological tendencies in these like different factions. So that's like really fascinating. I know I was like super dismissive of that Reva is a youngling theory last time, because it felt so direct to me that like we see the younglings, then there's like a Jedi running who's like, Obi-Wan, why are you out here in the desert? Help me. Oh, you won't? Oh my God, I'm dead. And I felt like that was a very obvious like jump that like this kid was one of the younglings and this is the carrying forward. But that feels like just maybe messy editing or an intentional misdirect. Like, I'm more and more sold on like Reva's got to be one of those kids, right? As we look back at that opening scene.
Reva is still a character that I have a tough time wrapping my mind around. I honestly, and this is not me like trying to cop out, you know, when we ask ourselves like, how do we feel about our character this episode? I honestly feel like I'm not going to be able to form an opinion about Reva one way or the other until we find out her story. Because I feel like so much is baked into her story. We're on the one hand, right? We could talk last week about being like, God, worst employee ever, like constantly shirks her boss's orders, kills her boss. Even this week, right? She's like, ah, you know what? I'm going to do my thing. You go, you know, scour the town. I'm going to go off on my own. But again, if she does have a rationale to go after Obi-Wan in particular, or perhaps like she has her own eyes to become the Grand Inquisitor, right? It seems like that's kind of what Vader made an arrangement for, of like, hey, if you find Kenobi, I'll make it worth your while. I'm just having a tough time like trying to couch my feelings on the character and her motivations when we don't exactly know them yet. And so I would not be surprised if like my thoughts on this character one way or the other completely flip-flop once we find out who she is and why she's doing what she's doing.
I find her really compelling so far. I think that this was in the Discord, and I'm going to forget who articulated it, so forgive me as I'm going to repeat this idea, that I think a part of what's so great about Reva, that we're seeing that like she doesn't just follow orders, she doesn't just get in line, she's lashing out, she's got her own like will and decisions. And part of this is like she very badly wants to be a Sith Lord, right? There is this notion that we get in the prequels that like the Sith, this rule of two, if you go deep into like your Star Wars homework, work. There's lore there, right? And the idea that, like, clearly there's a lot more than two Sith running around now, right? I mean, we got, like, we're literally naming them with numbering conventions at this point, right? So, like, her lashing out in this way, the, like, overt emotional display of rage and anger and fury and, like, F you, I won't do what you tell me, is her, like, fulfilling kind of her role as a Sith, right? It's her kind of like pursuing that, that like climbing up the echelon of like dark side power to like succumb to your hate and your anger and all this great stuff that makes you as well regaled and highly regarded as the great Lord Vader himself, right? So I think it's like very relatable in that way. And like the people who are missing that read, like, I think it's really noteworthy to keep that in mind. Like, she's not supposed to be like the rest to the Inquisitors. Like, she's got bigger aspirations. This is an ambitious character, right? And she's doing what the people with like more power than her did. So yeah, I don't know.
Well, on that note, I would actually love to sort of talk about some of the stuff that was unfortunately happening off the screen this week going into episode 3, where unfortunately, as much as we love talking about Star Wars, we don't exactly love talking about the Star Wars fan community for several reasons, and one of them is this, that Moses Ingram had a lot of targeted harassment towards her, some very, very serious and very just tragic threats towards her life, to the point where both the, you know, the official Star Wars social media accounts and Ewan McGregor himself put out a message and said, like, stop being D-bags. Listen, if you're doing this, you are the people that we're fighting in this. It's a pretty freaking big allegory for like the state of fascism that exists in the world today. So please stop the harassment. And obviously that is something that we put forward as well. But LaTanya, I would love to get your thoughts on, maybe not necessarily, let's not go into like the harassment against Moses Ingram, because I don't think anyone wants to open up, you know, that can of worms. But, you know, the reaction I think therefrom with Lucasfilm and Ewan McGregor, which it's sad to say, but we must say is unprecedented for them.
It is. So if you look back at some of the most recent Star Wars trilogy that we got, we had John Boyega and then we had Kelly Marie Tran. And those two people were just completely drugged through the mud by like just Star Wars fans who have gone as far to call these people diversity hires that are becoming like, have become like a big part of the universe. One of the reasons that I was so hesitant to even do a Star Wars podcast ever was not just that I wasn't familiar with the source material, but because I was not excited to be a part of a fan community that didn't seem to want me or want my opinion. Because that's what you kind of learn when you get that level of backlash, is that people don't want you around and they would rather that you be dead than be in their, you know, like, you know, Vader boy porn. I don't know how else to like describe it. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. And the thing that makes it even worse is that typically when there are backlashes that happened like that, the studio and or other actors and, on the set or the director will come out and say something resembling anything about how hate is bad and we need to have made this universe as inclusive as our universe, if not more so. There are just millions of species that exist, right? So we talk about Star Wars racism all the time, not in this context, but it's not just about Black characters. There are literal, you know, pig people like there that exist. It doesn't
frog
make
lady.
Sense. There's frog lady.
Wait, till we meet a mole guy.
I know.
He was
Zach Braff is killing it. So to see Moses Ingram go on Instagram Live and talk about the backlash that she's gotten, and then to, you know, see that this is the first time in the history of this type of backlash that Disney has actually made a statement about, it is a step. It is something more positive than doing nothing. I will say that Ewan McGregor is an executive producer on this show. Mm-hmm. And I think that his lead was amongst the things that prompted this action by Disney to happen. Because yes, we can look back to John Boyega and kind of like the him saying like, this is ridiculous, I can't believe no one stood up for me, and think that in the future that might influence how a large multinational corporation works. But it's Disney and still very conservative. And so I just want to say, really, thank you to our community, to the people of post-show recaps. I don't feel like I am out of my depth or like I am not welcome when I want to go on the Discord and chat with people about Star Wars anymore. That's just not something that I feel. And I just want everybody to kind of take the opportunity after you've listened to this podcast to go out there and put some positive Star Wars stuff into the ether, to kind of combat all of the negative things that we've gotten just from getting to have a Black villain. And it means a lot to me that there's a Black woman antagonist on this show. It really does. And it's one of the things that drew me to it, if I'm being honest. And so please go out there, put some light out to try to extinguish the dark.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just add my two cents, like from day one, Star Wars has been, a story about the value of diversity, of equality, where we're looking at like powerful female leaders. We're looking at a diverse rebel alliance fighting the white male fascist regime that is the empire. Like, if you can't perceive the allegory in that over 40 years of storytelling, I cannot help you, my friends. But I think that this is a sad truth about a lot of fandoms that we exist in the modern age. There is a very loud, very vocal, very toxic contingent of the community that make a lot of noise when this kind of stuff happens. And the reality is, like, you know, we just had Star Wars Celebration happen last week. We get to exist in post-show recaps in this space that is so inclusive and aggressively welcoming and positive. And we are really, like, strive to kind of shatter the walls of, like, the gates and the gatekeepers that hold people out of fandoms. As somebody that works professionally in, like, tabletop role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons, this is a space that shares a lot of like the same kind of issues, right? And I think it's like really important to note, like, the loud, like, bad faith actors out there, go away, go to your holes on your like caves and Tatooine. We do not need you. There's no like need for that in the discourse. And the reality is, like, there's so many people out here who like celebrate this stuff, and this is the like tie that binds us, right? And is this connective tissue that allows us to like find one another and develop relationships and inspires people to like go out into the world and do great things. And it's BS, you know, that they're gonna like come after this woman who's like a Yale trained Shakespearean level actress who's delivering an awesome performance. Save it for your friends at like the dinner table. Like, keep it off the internet or I'm over it, right?
During the course of the episode, Leia asks Obi-Wan what the Force is comparable to. And he talks about, you know, if you wake up and you're scared of the dark and you turn on a light and you feel better, that's what he says the Force is. And to LaTanya's point, be that Force out there if you're able to. Be that light to blot out a lot of darkness that surrounds us, because that does help a lot of people feel better, including those that are putting their blood, sweat, and tears into doing, you know, such a role that might make dreams come true. We hate to ruin the experiences of those that are truly pouring all their effort into doing this stuff just because you don't like, you know, for many reasons, the characters or the choices that are made. So again, I hope we are preaching to the choir here, and there's not necessarily anybody out there who is thinking of doing that. But just in case, consider that our official statement. I want to get to some Leia and Obi-Wan stuff, because it was fantastic. Leia specifically, and I sort of loved the two-hander here, which is not often found in Star Wars. Usually it's one hand, but where Leia is able to be like the talker, right? And like get their way onto Freck's truck by coming up with this entire story, really surprising Obi-Wan, who tells her like, don't talk, it's fine, I'll take care of it. And then when push comes to shove, Obi-Wan does save her at this, like, you know, border crossing where he's able to just gun down five stormtroopers, essentially, and knock out Freck in one fell swoop. I think that was a nice representation, LT, of, like, the balance of their partnership, albeit a bit short-lived.
Yeah, I adored how they were trying to get their story straight, and she goes, I can't talk, or I won't talk.
Yeah, I can't like talk talking. I don't like to talk. He's like, you don't talk.
You
That's
don't
all
talk.
You need to know.
You just do not speak. And then the second thing, the first thing that happens after that is, hi, you know, her speaking. I think their little duo is adorable. It's, you know, kind of, kids are great Trojan horses, honestly. Like, you can't help but seem like a friendly do-gooder person when you've got a little kid with you and someone who's saying hi and saying, be polite, say hi, dad. And so I really liked that. And we got that great moment that we talked about earlier when they were actually on the little, like, transport when the stormtroopers were there, where he was able to discuss, for someone who is definitely on the run, he talks about being a Jedi a lot. I'm just going to say that.
He's also calling her Leia, which I feel like is not a good move when you're on the run to be like, hi, Princess Leia.
Princess
I know that
Leia? Like, how did none of them heard of her?
Yeah, she brought up last week that she knows she's not the one that they want, but still, like, any sort of sense of undercoverness is sort of out the window at that point.
For sure. But their little duo, I thought, was very cute. Those two characters have really great chemistry together, and that's hard to accomplish with kids.
Oh yeah,
most kid actors just have nothing behind the eyes, and you're just trying to see what you can.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a really, really cute relationship together, and you can tell that they, you know, they're partners in crime. They're almost equals, really, which is something that you don't get a lot of when you get relationships with kids and older individuals.
That's part of what I loved about this is like the subversion obviously is right there of like, oh, okay, let's put the kid in the driver's seat for a minute of like calling the shots. And it's so emblematic of Leia, right? Of like the quick on her toes, fast thinker. She's like quick in handling this. What I love about this is how they're both right in certain ways. Like he's telling her, Leia, not all people are good before they get on the thing. And he's angry, right? He's angry because he's afraid. Because he's like, no, you need to like get your head around this. You can't just go wandering in the desert like, hey, I need help, hey, like, this is not great, this is not a great world for you to
have. Not Alderaan.
But at the same time, like, you know, while he's right, while it does like prove out that like Freck is like maybe not a great dude here, ultimately like she's right too, right? And like the scene itself is charming. The two of them, to LT's point, they have great chemistry. There's like a delightful banter back and forth between the two of them. It's such a small moment even, but just when he like picks her up and takes her down off the back of the kind of transport, it's so like, oh God, like I don't have kids, but it's such a dad moment. And like you can, the comfortableness between the two of them, like there's something ephemeral there that's like translating. But it's this notion that like she's teaching him a lesson of like, dude, you can't just hide in the cave and assume everybody is out to get you, or like you're doomed. Like you have to be able to ask for help. And it's a lesson he knows already, right? But he's also teaching her a lesson of like, yo, you can't just see the best in everybody. Like
right.
You could try. Yep. We could try to be hopeful. It's important that we're optimistic, but we need to be like pragmatic at the same time. And both of them having truth in this moment, I think it just lends it all so much more strength after you come out of the scene, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Totally. And especially after that checkpoint scene happens and like the dust has settled a bit, she is really for like the first time in a long time on the show scared, right?
Yeah.
She admits to him like, yeah, I ran away because, you know, I was afraid of you. I just want to go home. And that's really, I think, for the first time for me when that child aspect comes out, because again, she's been so precocious through three episodes. And like, this is the first time where she just says, I want my mom. I want to go home. I want to see 3PO.
She's a scared kid. Yeah.
She's scared. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's a really, really great moment. LT, do you have something else you wanted to say?
No. I just, one thing that we didn't talk about last week, because this Star Wars is ultimately all about family, mm-hmm. and the, whether it's your chosen family or your actual family. And I just thought it was really interesting when we were talking about father daughter relationships on this show, that Ewan McGregor's actual daughter was in the show in the first, in second episode.
Yeah. She was the pink haired, spice trader, right? That like pointed him towards Haja, and was also like, oh, well, this is a kind of crappy place. So good luck.
Yeah. Everyone's someone's child. I really, again, it's the Grogu effect for me. It's always going to be the tough warrior guy and then put him with a kid and let's see what happens. And I really enjoyed their little repartee this episode.
I do want to talk about Freck for a hot second. First, you know, Zach Braff playing yet another scrub in a very different way in the form of this mole person, which I have never seen before in Star Wars. Yeah. So it was like a little uncanny valley to me, but like, cool. Listen, we have pig aliens, we have, you know, octopus aliens. Let's put mole aliens in there.
Proboscis as well. Was a little off-putting, huh, Mike? Yeah.
Well, specifically like the anthropomorphized vestigial like motion while it was going on.
Yeah, but a lot happening there. Yeah.
Josh Lehmer, as I sort of parse in some feedback here, did bring in like a little bit of sort of thematic utility of Freck as well, where he says that was a really great representation of a person who seems kind of humble and a salt of the earth blue collar person who probably treats his friends and family members very well, who nonetheless has bought into a fascist agenda out of a combination of complacency, propaganda, and willful ignorance. A fantastic representation of the kinds of everyday evil that seeps into the types of people we might actually meet in our everyday lives. And yeah, the more you think about it, the more you realize that we sort of meet Freks every day, right? Especially out there on those internet streets. We're like, if you meet them as a person, yeah, they'll give you a ride. They seem totally friendly, but they have sort of copped into a strategy of, in this case, an objectively evil society and head of an organization that then allows them to do bad things, even with good intentions.
Mm-hmm. Under the guise of order. Like law and order. Mm-hmm. I believe he literally at one point says there's nothing wrong with a little order.
Yep, he does. He tosses that line. Everybody needs a little order, right? Yeah.
And it is very, it's so interesting, and you often probably encounter this most if you're listening to post-show recaps at some type of family event. But it's always interesting to see those people kind of come out of the woodwork, and then you realize they've totally bought in. But then you realize, you know, again, that the whole point of fascism is that it's easy. It's something that you can just easily grasp onto because the world doesn't make sense and bad things happen all the time. And if someone comes around and they tell you that they're here to clean things up, even though we know from Obi-Wan saying this used to be an actual like fields of grass with people and families, and now it's just kind of a barren wasteland, like a desert. There's nothing there except these outposts and like transport ships and things like that. But yeah, fascism really does sneak up on you. It's a hell of a drug.
To your point, right? It wins because it's easy, right? It's the path of least resistance for a lot of people. I think what Josh is articulating here is really brilliant. It's said very excellently. I think that it piggybacks off of that prequel scene of like, this is how democracy dies, and thunderous applause, right? It is that like, frog boiling in the pot type situation of like the slow rolling change. You know, all it takes is like a planet of Freks that are like, well, I get the trains run on time. My grandmother grew up in Italy pre-World War II, and she used to speak to me about the rise of Mussolini, okay? Jeez. And this is like a very personal anecdote, but nonetheless, like, she would talk about how, like, no, you don't understand. When Mussolini came to power, the people were like, oh, thank God, there's books in the schools. We can get on, like, the bus to get where we gotta go. There's food in the stores, right? Order. Everybody likes a little bit of order, right? And it answers these problems in a world that is filled with unanswerable questions, LT. It's like the other side of that religion coin that I think is really interesting, because ultimately, like, people, whether they're in Earth watching Star Wars or in a galaxy far, far away, need assurance and certainty. It is fearful to exist. It is frightening and uncertain to wake up every day and not know what the galaxy holds in store for you. And so whether it is a clergy member, whether it's the Jedi Master telling you, like, no, release your attachments, follow this path and everything will be all right, or the Empire, like, no, just get in line, you know, take your job, get your credits, punch the clock, like, there is an assurance there that allows people to fall into a system. And I think it's like part of the best stuff of Star Wars is in the DNA of exploring these ideas that just happen in small scenes through little bits of dialogue like this, but are really articulating very big ideas, right?
It reminds me a bit of Attack of the Clones when Anakin has a very cringy scene, but communicated nonetheless, right? Of, I don't think the system works. And, you know, Padme asked him, like, well, what did you want? He's like, well, I think that they should just have, like, one person unilaterally making decisions so we don't get everything held up in, like, stupid bureaucracy. And one person should make all the decisions. And even if people don't want to do it, they should be made to do it. And again, it's this idea of not necessarily you can sympathize with it, but you could see why he ended up taking that perspective, especially once you get the context of the Clone Wars as well, right? When he starts to realize that the system that he is working in, like, had some kind of BS involved, that he's like, yeah, you know what? Maybe it would be easier to just have one person making all the decisions. Maybe that would just make everything easier. We can just put our heads down, focus on what matters to us the most, and then everyone else will worry about the other things. Now, on the opposite side of that, we have Tala. Guest rolled here by Indira Varma. I don't know if she's going to appear in episode 4. I would assume so, considering where we left things off. But here is an Imperial worker with the little green and the blue and red, like, chiclets on the side and everything. She is an Imperial officer who is sort of like what you suspected Reva to be earlier, LT. She is a bit of a turncoat. She's assisting Obi-Wan here. Definitely seems like she is working undercover to assist getting people out, much like Haja did last week. I know that you said you had a lot of thoughts about her, so give me your thoughts on Tala.
So I love Indira Varma. I know that a lot of people probably know her the best from Game of Thrones, but mm-hmm. I've been following her career since she was Niobe on in Rome, another HBO show.
Sure, I can't believe I forgot that, LT.
She's awesome, and I've always loved her as an actress. I think that there's something, even though she had on the garb, there's just something about the way that her face was relaxed that for me led me to believe that she would be a turncoat and not there to enforce some type of order. I love the idea that this is where we've kind of, I mean, obviously the entirety of Star Wars is a big old metaphor for the Holocaust. And I love that this is kind of the episode of this series where we get an introduction to what is essentially the Underground Railroad of being able to, like, ferret people to and from places of danger to get people out of harm's way. So she's a part of the resistance who clearly knows her own self. I love the little detail of how she keeps her blaster in a certain position so that she can draw it more easily. She's a kind person, it seems, but you can also tell she's been through some shit. So I'm just really looking forward to, you know, getting more from her. And I love anyone who loves a droid. I know that there are some people who can be disrespectful to droids on in these different, like, Star Wars properties, but the idea that she's saying, you know, this droid can't necessarily communicate, but droids are people, actions speak louder than words. And so I think we'll see kind of her teaming up with some of these giant asteroids in order to help. I mean, one of those would really come in handy in carrying scorched Obi-Wan right now, right? But yeah, just her character from the beginning was kind of a flash of lightning that I was excited to see. And I love her energy. And so I'm excited to see what happens next week with her.
Yeah, Rich, what are you thinking on a scale of, like, lightning strike to the Emperor? How much lightning are you getting from Tala in this episode?
I loved her. I was totally shocked. I did not expect her to be the turncoat. I kind of didn't realize it was her. She's kind of walking up into the scene. Oh my God, the blasters start firing and she turns everything. But where it plays out, I think everything that ends up with her and Obi-Wan and as she's talking about it, you know, like, I date myself all the time, but I came up at an age where, like, Clerks kind of hit in the late 90s. And there's that very famous Kevin Smith speech about, like, what about the janitors on the Death Star? What about all the other people? And, like, mm-hmm. It was just this idea articulating, like, but what about all the rank and file of the Empire? You know, and it was an idea that was so awesome about Finn in The Force Awakens, this idea of, like, what about a stormtrooper that's like, dude, how do I get off the ship? You know, I love this, what she articulates with Obi-Wan. I signed up. It was too late. Once I thought it was something other than what it is, because it's a direct counterpoint to Zach Braff Moleman over here, right? Who's, like, just willing to kind of go with the flow is in order nice, where, like, she signs up with these, like, high-minded ideals and realizes, like, oh, this is not that.
this is something altogether different and in fact needs to be like torn down. And everything that we get with between the two of them in this kind of underground bunker, the Quinlan Voss call out, the writing on the wall. Dude, there's like just so much cool stuff in that. But like, yeah, this is a character that you could put somewhere in the heart of like another series that I would be excited to continue watching, right? Of like Indira Varma, you know, smuggles people out of empire controlled space. I'm in.
Yeah, I kind of love exploring this thing, right? Because again, the Skywalker saga has been, understandably so Jedi focused, that's why, again, Finn was another exciting character, even though there was a little bit of murkiness as to like, is he force sensitive? Is he not? Because it's cool to just like see a non-forcey person get involved in a lot of this stuff and to really answer those questions of world building. It's not just the most important people in the galaxy revolves around them. There's a whole entire populace filled with creatures of various shapes and sizes and ranks. And so it's been cool to see like between Haja last week and now Tala this week to see like, how did the rest of the galaxy react to Order 66? Right? Mm-hmm. Was everyone like, oh, thank God the Jedi are gone. They were the true evil, you know, really drinking the Kool-Aid that the Emperor was putting out there? Or were there those like I just spoke about who say, this isn't right. Let me make sure I can try to help these people in the midst of persecution. It's a really effective way of world building without it being like too, again, over the top and glaring over all the other cool stuff that is happening. So you mentioned Quinlan Voss, just doing a quick little like galaxy lore corner here. So Quinlan Voss is a character that was introduced in the Clone Wars, that he was in a few episodes. The one that I remember specifically is when Cad Bane breaks Zero the Hutt out of Coruscant. I'm pretty sure Obi-Wan goes on a mission with Quinlan Voss to go get him. Now, I think Zero the Hutt is dead by the time they get to him, but that is a thing that he's known for. I do believe like there's a canonical novel where I think he actually partners up with Asajj Ventress, who ends up being a bit of a turncoat as well. But it's also nice in that we get a little drips and drabs here of like, okay, who survived Order 66? So you can imagine by like the hobo scrawlings on the side of the tunnel here, Quinlan Voss was here, that he was able to survive in addition to like your Yodas and your Obi-Wans.
It's so cool. It's such a cool little Easter egg for the folks that do love it. We talk a lot about the old EU novels that are no longer canon and what is canon. And like, there's so much other Star Wars that people have like spent the decades in and spent steeped in these characters like a Quinlan Voss. So just get name dropped there. And like the idea that like, yeah, no, this is part of the world that you know and love. It's very cool. It's a very fun little beat. And it adds texture and depth to like, yeah, you know, Obi-Wan knew more than like three other Jedi, you know what I mean? Like there is a larger kind of weight to the organization and the suggestion that like there were more people that are connected to each other through all of this, right?
So let's get into really the climax of the episode and honestly the climax of the series up to this point, right? As they're about to ferret into the tunnel and he just feels something. You can almost see the goose pimples going up on the back of his neck if you're watching in 4K as he senses something and he looks out onto the street and here Darth Vader is just processing slowly and just like force choking and breaking necks for no particular reason. It's not like he interrogated them at all. It's not like in A New Hope where like one of these Imperial officers ticked him off, just some random person. You know, this is the slippery slope that killing all of those Tusken Raiders got him to, where he is just slaughtering people in the street. It is so interesting to me because this feels a bit like 2020 Star Wars to me, where again, I feel like especially 70s Star Wars, but even stuff going on with Attack of the Clones, like I mentioned, largely lots of violence took place off screen with the exception of, you know, chopping up of limbs and all that I was like, I don't know, I was kind of surprised to see Darth Vader snap a neck. I was not unhappy with it because, again, it was a really cool visceral image that just represents how much he quite literally lost his heart. But LT, it was something where I had to be like, oh, damn, Darth Vader just straight up murdered somebody.
Yeah, so this scene was really cool for a lot of reasons. All of the horror elements were there because you kind of have Obi-Wan almost like as if it looks like he gets sick to his stomach almost. Like
almost
it's just
like a panic attack, right? It looks
exactly,
like he's having like a heart attack for a moment. Yeah.
Yes. And then you realize just the connection between these two people and how strong that is and how much it's soured. And that must have been what he felt in the moment that, you know, Darth Vader came there. And the fact that he didn't just send his like little minions to handle this. He was just like, we have confirmation before he killed that one droid that he is here. I am going there because he will ache like I ache. And so just seeing him force choke someone and then, you know, snap the neck of a child, that was like a young person, really was evocative for me of like a big cat, like just kind of prowling and kind of having his way with his surroundings and just being pissed off and getting good and angry for the hunt and the fight. He doesn't really need a reason, no matter what side you're on, to kill you or to force choke you. That's been shown in like very many different ways. So to see him do that is just kind of a bit of him letting out like the anger, just like you can feel it radiating off of him, just how mad he is and how he's about to finally get what he wants. And it's like, even if he just has to walk down a street, somehow these people are offending him by being in his path. They're in his way. And he's just a predator in this moment. And I think it's so cool. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's such cool imagery and such an opportunity for us to see just how evil this person has become.
It's a grand slam scene, right? Yeah. I mean, I think like all of it right out of the rip, Ewan McGregor is like killing it as you get that look on his face. And there's this moment of like, oh God, what's happening to him? Oh no. Like he's really coming apart. Like part of me is like, is this PTSD? Like, is he just having a straight up panic attack here of like, oh my God, I have got to get this kid off this planet. They're coming for me. Everything's cracking down. And then you realize like, oh no, he's here. And the reveal, the distance, the shot, as like we're looking out of the window of the building and you kind of can't quite make it out like, oh, those are Inquisitors. Oh no, he's here, right? And I think that like there's clear intention as he's murdering these people coming down the street of like, okay, Obi-Wan, like how many are gonna die while you cower in your like little hole and watch me, because you know that I'm here and I know that you're here, right?
That's what the Grand Inquisitor said in the first episode, right? The Jedi hunt themselves. That was the entire onus of the first scene, is like, I do something to someone, their good guy complex is going to come in and they're inevitably going to show themselves.
Exactly. He cannot help but to react here, right? We've seen Obi-Wan like kind of like subsume these feelings and manage them, like quell them down. He leaves like the Jedi, I cannot help you. I cannot like put myself in harm's way. And he's only able to do that because it's a very immediate need of like, I have to be alive here to protect Luke. I can't afford to like get myself killed getting, you know, like Jedi Joe off Tatooine when Luke Skywalker is over here growing up. So we're like back into the immediacy of this moment, and the fact that he has to make the choice here, like it being Vader, it being Anakin, he's got to turn back. It's too close. He's too close to Leia, and the beat of like Leia saying to him, go, right? It's so good because like we keep talking about the precocious kid, and it could be like a bridge too far, but it's not. It's like right there. It's just right. You know, it's like Goldilocks Leia of like, perfect, yes, like turn him loose, you know. It just was so powerful, and the tension leading up to it all is like so incredible. I was completely swept up.
So let's talk about the encounter between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader. Now, before we get into the execution of it itself, which I thought was just stunning in so many ways, let's get into what I would imagine, Rich, is maybe one of the source of your complicated feelings. We spoke about this last week, right? This idea that it had been quote-unquote canonized that Obi-Wan and Vader, that this was presumably the first time they'd faced each other since that battle in Mustafar in episode 3. And I know that people feel a certain way, us included, about the fact that like we sort of darted around this of like, okay, maybe they won't see each other. They flat out have not only seen each other, but had a full-out lightsaber fight prior to episode 4. How does this make you feel?
I don't know. It was so good. Let me just like stop right here and unequivocally say, it's awesome, right? It's like a really good fight. It's visually wild. There's incredible like emotional weight. It's charged. It's got all the stuff that it needs to have to be like an excellent, like amongst the best of the lightsaber duels. It's visually powerful. It's emotional, but like, I don't know. I don't necessarily mind the pacing that it happened. Since like this whole thing was revealed and information's coming out and we've been podcasting, I'm reconciling myself with like, this is gonna happen, dude. You got to get on the bus, you know. So now that it's happened, it's like I feel like there was such strength in like the tension of that moment, and Obi-Wan continuing to run as like Vader is like chasing him through the buildings, and then he even lights up the lightsaber and he runs, and it's like, dude, this is really good. Like, I really like this. And then they fight, and I don't know how I feel about it. I really don't. Like, part of me is so satisfied. It was very cool to watch. I'm not worried about it like decanonizing anything, but it's just like, all right, but are they going to fight again for the next three episodes? Are they going to like fight every episode for the rest of the season? Like, I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel. Is that fair, LT? Do I sound like a crazy person?
No, not this time.
Tip thinks in absolutes. That's a very Jedi-like answer.
Yeah, no, I completely understand where you're coming from. For me, though, it wasn't, thematically, in terms of the weight of their relationship and what's going on between the saga of these two characters, yes, it ranks up there really high in terms of lightsaber duels, but like Obi-Wan was just barely defending himself. It's obvious that he has not been training. Like, he gave up the ways of the Jedi and he's just been building toys for this kid and, you know, like going to
cutting
work
sashimi. Yeah,
exactly. And so it takes literally everything that he has to be able to keep from getting killed immediately, and it's just his instincts that lead him to turn around at just the right time when we get that like iconic red lightsaber light up like right behind his back so that he can kind of parry it away. I think that for me, the coolest scene is just kind of part of the scene is not the lightsaber battle itself, but when they are kind of like when Vader is stalking his prey kind of throughout. And then he activates whatever these shards are that turn into like a river of fire and just starts to slowly drag Obi-Wan across this. And you can just tell that that is something that he has been thinking about doing for 10 years. And it's just, there's just something that's so wild about it. I completely by how they were able to get out of this situation at the end. I don't, because Vader is not just, doesn't just have all of his inquisitors there. He's got a ton of stormtroopers for whatever good they're worth. But you know, like the idea that only Indira Varma's character would be able to like stop this from happening, essentially by making there be more fire, which I'm sure Anakin could have extinguished with the Force. I don't know. So I get it. And it is very quick for us in our new age of watching TV and what we expect from television to get this type of level of action between these two characters so soon.
I think you nailed the thing that's like getting me. So much of the excitement for me was in the cat and mouse of it, right? That I think it's like that Jaws dynamic that like once we actually got to the fight itself, and so much of it's like really powerful as he's dragging him through the fire. Like, you 100% get that. This is a man with like who's been nursing this like desire for revenge, right? And it's really powerful. It's just like, okay, well, where do we go from here, right? Like, I've been so impressed with like how much restraint they've showed. I love the notion that like he reaches for the lightsaber and then kind of like doesn't pull it and then like kind of runs, and eventually like he has to, right? The blue lights up and it's all so powerful. And I think they could have really, for me at least, gotten away with like dancing out of these episodes with the two of them having seen each other, having had this confrontation and not having cross blades at all, right? Having Obi-Wan like panic and turn and run would have been very satisfying for me, I think. That said, like, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Because I would disagree. I think Obi-Wan like needed this fight to learn something from it, right? Not only about Anakin, but about himself, of like,
true.
Oh, this is not like riding a speeder bike. Because I loved the fact that this dude was just like getting the crap beaten out of him. First, the image of him lighting up the blue lightsaber and that blue glow against his face in the darkness, like that will live with me for a while. That was beautiful. So freaking cool.
That's a but one perfect shot moment, Mike. Yeah.
Yeah. One in a million, if you will. But I love the idea that like it's clear that this is not Mustafar, right? Where it was Obi-Wan literally had the higher ground last time and like was able to just, Anakin was able to stay with him for a while, but he, at the end of the day, he is this sort of like impetuous, emotionally charged kid. And so he charges at Obi-Wan and Obi-Wan just goes slice, slice, like he's at the sashimi factory all over again and leaves him to die. And now this is almost like the student has become the master in its own way of like, now I have been fueled with what, I mean, Obi-Wan says, what have you become? And Vader says, I am what you made me.
And
that shows it not only from like a literal mechanical perspective, but in his technique as well of like, you almost trained me to be who I am right now, which not only digs in even harder for Obi-Wan, but allows him to really realize that through his fighting style. So I'm going to imagine this is going to be a little bit of like our sports movie trope now of maybe not a training thing. I don't think he's getting the helmet on there anytime soon and the ball shooting the lasers. But I do think this was necessary for Obi-Wan to like realize it's just out of how out of touch he is. And when it comes to the aspects of canon, I'm not sure if this is a hot take, but like as both a fan of Star Trek and Star Wars, I sort of just become really, you know, sitting into the fact that as these pop culture franchises continue to develop decades upon decades of canon, for me, I am much more lenient on things that break canon if they tell a good story. If I'm watching Star Trek V and I'm like, oh, Spock has a brother, that's interesting, and it's not really well done, I am less likely to excuse that than something here where it's, okay, so they didn't necessarily meet for the first time since, you know, episode 3 and episode 4. But there's story reason, there's thematic reason, and there's visual reason behind why it's happening now. To your point, Rich, will probably happen again at least one more time. So I personally am not too mad at it at all. And I just think it was one of those things where I was sitting there in disbelief, not only at just the artistic quality of it, to your point, LT, just the brutality of Darth Vader being like, I want to do to you what you did to me. You deserve nothing less. Is just a wild thing. And you think Darth Vader is seen as like senselessly cruel for a lot of things. He just broke some random kid's neck. But this is different. This is charged. This has rationale behind it, which makes it even scarier.
I guess like my final thought here that I think that like where I'm not that hung up on canon either, right? Like if it's good, it's good, right? And as long as like we're not like explicitly just like deleting like primary core values of the story, then like it's fine. And I do think in one way it's really additive because Obi-Wan ultimately is telling Luke, like Luke is like, I can't kill my father, right? And they're like, well, then we've already lost, right? There is this sense that Obi-Wan talking to Luke is like, he does not have the same optimism that Luke does, that there is still good left in your father and he can be saved. And so I think in this way, this scene cements that canonically for the movies that were made 40 years ago. Like in that sense, I think they really did a lot of service to what already exists, right? For me, it's much more about the last three episodes and like how they're going to use the relationship between these two, how much we're going to lean in on that, and what like the next and final confrontation between them ultimately look like, that I'm like, I don't know, worried is the wrong word, but anxious about, I guess, you know. I do think it's a really good scene, and I'm more pleased that I am confused, I guess, in closing.
Yeah, so let's sort of, I guess, go to where we ended up starting this entire podcast about where we leave things, right? Reva is able to take Leia. I was a little confused about that because it seemed like she was following them the entire time. Maybe, I don't know, she was able to sense her and take another route, but she has taken her under the guise of, like, get in the car with the stranger. It's okay, I'm the one to take you. Meanwhile, it seems like Tala has pulled Obi-Wan from the fire and they are going to a place called Jabim. So we shall see what that means, whether that's from like a healing perspective or whether they're just sort of being ferried around to like friends of the Force in a manner of speaking, like sympathizers with the Jedi. I'm not entirely sure, but considering where we leave things for both Obi-Wan and Darth Vader, LaTanya, like what do you expect their paths to be? To Rich's point before, do you expect like him to continue to be on that chase personally? Is he going to take a step back and have Reva continue forward? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, this is... For me, this is the part that I just don't know. Like, I think that having everything that happened in part three happen has really thrown off my compass for where the rest of the show is going to take us. Because, we see that Reva has Leia. What does that mean? We see that somehow Tala has been able to stop this particular fight and maybe get Obi-Wan off to safety. It's the mechanics of it that don't make sense to me. They're all in the same place. How exactly are they going to escape and go someplace else? I'm guessing that Leia will go with Reva back to wherever, like, what is it called? The like Mr. Megorium's Imperatorium.
That's exactly. Yeah.
Listen, for what it's worth, that place looked really interesting. I mean, it's a truly evil place when there is not a chair to be found. Those people have been standing around all day.
Standing desks only in the Empire.
Well, it's like a giant waiting room and like only the Inquisitors can sit. That's the thing. Like, really, Reva only wants to become Grand Inquisitor so she can like have a chair with her name
on it. She wants to sit down. Let that woman sit.
Can I have a chair?
So, but for me, like treading the old, now Leia is a prisoner again and going to be used as bait again. And this is probably the next episode will be some type of combination of a flashback to like Anakin and something dealing with Anakin and however it is that that Obi-Wan is going to be able to recuperate and wherever that is. And then they all kind of converge eventually, because I think in the commercials for the series there is a battle at that Wonder Emporium, and so I don't know what's gonna happen. It's a really cool place to be, I guess, because my speculation is not with me today, and I guess it's nice to not know what to look forward to in a show for once.
Rich, can you prognosticate at all, or are you similarly in the same boat as LT at this point?
I'm in a kind of similar space, and I love it, to your point, LT. Like, I love, like, not being sure what they're going to do. I think part of, like, what's been so successful about the Star Wars shows on Disney Plus is, like, them giving us the thing we didn't know we wanted, you know? How long have people been talking about Obi-Wan? Like, I think, you know, the overwhelming majority of us were very shocked that Leia is, like, a feature character in this series, right? Mm-hmm. I very naively was like, well, she'll just be here for a couple episodes. Like, I don't know, Mike. I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'm very excited. I do think we get some kind of Boba Fett-esque Obi-Wan healing, Obi-Wan reflecting on his past, musing. There seems to, I think, to your point, Mike, like this battle was important to Obi-Wan. Like, while I would have been okay to see him dance out of the episode without it, I think there's like a major paradigm shift internally for him in terms of how he thinks about Anakin Skywalker, how he thinks about his role and like the necessity of what he has to do here. So I'm really intrigued. Like, obviously we're going to get some cool conflict between he and Reva at some point. I feel like that's inevitable. I can't wait to see Vader with the Inquisitors a little more. I feel like that's a thing I really want to dig into. I think it's a great way to like use Vader and to get a little bit more depth on some of those characters. And I'm really curious to see how Leia gingerly trots away from the enemies this time. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's no chairs for her to put in their way. So, like, they have a clear path to her. It's nothing but floor if they go to bigger than that one building.
She can't even knock chairs over.
So let's talk about a couple of pieces of feedback. Again, we are recording these, you know, fairly quick to the episode dropping. It's usually on Wednesday afternoons, but of course you can send in your feedback, StarWars@postshowrecaps.com, or if you're a part of the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord, we're pulling stuff from there as well. I want to start with Austin, who said, I did not expect things to escalate that quickly. And before I'm sure there'll be complaints about how ordinary the location of the climax was, I'm going to get in and say I actually loved it, being an understated, almost banal quarry. Nothing is going to top the absurdly cinematic Mustafar, and the smallness of this confrontation felt personal rather than sweepingly epic. And that's the story we're telling here. And seeing Vader's menace in the village was spine-chilling, and the evoking of the lava river with the burning minerals was perfect. Yeah, I think Austin hit on a really good point, not only with the setting, but also, like, again, why I enjoyed that confrontation between Vader and Obi-Wan compared to episode 4 was it felt much smaller and more personal in this way. And maybe it was the setting, maybe it was the stakes, maybe it was the fact that it wasn't really a fight, more so that this guy's like, But I really enjoyed the fact that it shows how on any planet in Star Wars, right, that was the entire onus of Tatooine, and this little hole-in-the-wall desert planet is where, you know, the next great Jedi Force lives. And I liked getting that reintroduction here. I know that it's a little bit of like, we were just on Tatooine, now we're on this mining planet, but we at least had the city in episode 2 to serve as a nice buffer in between.
The term the absurdly cinematic Mustafar is giving me great joy, so thank you for that, Austin. But I think that, like, it's very evocative of the Obi-Wan Vader duel in episode 4, where a lot of the duel is tight shots of their faces with lightsabers waving in front of it, right? LT, like I got, like, that vibe from it in, like, this modernized era. Like, I think it was a great setting for the duel, being, like, a simple, understated kind of location.
So let's talk about something that, LaTanya, I know you're going to be thrilled about. Nick W. said, one thing this episode leaves me wanting, a show or miniseries that takes a very dark look at the whole youngling program, the trauma and reality of what ripping children from their parents and telling them not to love looks like.
Yes. So I have been Jedi our cult for as long as I've been podcasting about Star Wars. It was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away when I was still doing the Something of the Stars, that little segment that I did, where I talked about the Jedi being a cult. I would absolutely love to see that, as well as, like, focusing on the families that were left behind, and maybe there's some type of program that is, like, there to try to get the kids back so that they can be with the people that they care about. But just the idea of seeing what that indoctrination looks like, the idea of being told that you are here for the light and here to do good, but you're not allowed to form attachments to anyone or to love anyone, is just very weird. It's just a weird idea. And they're celibate as well. So they're just not allowed to have any fun at all. Yeah, that would be a really cool, really sinister look at things from the top, and I would like to see it.
And what do you think, Rich? Is this something that you would... Seems like it's almost like, I don't know, LaTanya's also personifying, like, both the younglings' side of, like, almost a military boot camp, but then, like, the leftovers with the families that have this children taken from them.
True. It's kind of fascinating. I mean, like, I, you know, there's so many other Star Wars properties where we delve into this a little bit. We're getting, like, some different eras of Star Wars shows coming up. This is a really interesting space to dig into, is, like, the gray space between light and dark, right? It's very fascinating and worth identifying. I mean, I think it's part of what Lucas is explicitly talking about in the prequel trilogies. It is clearly part of Anakin's, like, descent and fall from grace. Like, the Jedi sound great when they're all extinct and the only point of reference we have are old wizards in, like, you know, desert caves and space swamps that are, like, pontificating romantically about the days of yore, right? But the reality of, like, yeah, they took me from my family when I was young enough that I don't remember my mother's face. Like, that's heavy, man. This would be, like, great to explore. I don't know. I love it. I dig it. I think there's a lot of, like, good juice in there for storytelling, for sure.
Well, the Vader-Obi-Wan showdown was not the only question of canon. This is from the great Brendan Fitzpatrick, who really just puts forward a galaxy's worth of effort every week to get all this feedback in on time. But he does ask, you know, in the intro with Darth Vader in this episode, like, he pretty much confirms, as well as Reva, right? The Grand Inquisitor doesn't matter. The Grand Inquisitor is dead. So he asked the question that we sort of danced around last week. It seems like the Grand Inquisitor is actually dead. What does this do to the canon of Rebels? Should we be concerned? Does it matter if the show contradicts anything in canon? Now, we sort of talked about that last question, but Rich, is it as simple as the Jason Isaacs Grand Inquisitor we see in Rebels is not the Rupert Friend one that just died?
Sure, it could be. I'm not gonna like break my brain thinking about these questions too much because they could be frustrating, and that's not what I'm showing up for Star Wars for. So I guess my question would be, like, if they're supposed to be different characters, why were they not visually like very disparate in a world with like millions of alien species? To your point, LT, we don't need to make them the same kind of alien. Like, so there's a lot of
alive.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion here. I think probably he's just alive. I think, like, at the point that we exist at in, like, pop culture in general, but certainly Star Wars in 2022, death does not mean the end, right? And, like, we could easily just roll this guy back out with some robot legs. No big deal. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
I read something about how this species has two stomachs.
There you go.
Oh.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you don't even need two stomachs, though. We saw Fennec Shand just fully get automated.
Yeah,
out, right?
Or yeah, we've even seen cloning exist in the Star Wars universe. Granted, yeah, it's still a few years off, but, like, if they want to pilot a cloning program in case Emperor Palpatine's, like, making those contingency plans in case anything goes south, he could try it on his Grand Inquisitor.
They just need to bring him to Thundercat out in Tatooine, though. They can give him a robot stomach. He'll be fine, man. Yeah.
Yeah, one of those other, luckily one of the musicians who appeared on Star Wars that did not die, right? I'm pretty sure that guy at the Hot Topic mod parlor didn't die.
Oh, he better not ever. Somebody riots, yeah.
Well, hopefully you did not all riot as we covered episode 3 of Obi-Wan Kenobi. I have been having so much fun with this show. Again, like you said, there are questions. I think right now a lot of us are left in a place of, like, we don't know where we're going. We don't know how to feel about certain things, but, like, I feel excited about that because, again, a lot of stuff, especially in some of the stuff with the sequel trilogy, was like a little bit paint by numbers and a little bit of like, we know where things are going and therefore we know to feel about it. They were breaking a lot of new ground here, which really, really excites me. They're like lighting so many things on fire and I am just eating it up, even though you should not eat fire. That's how you end up like Anakin Skywalker. I cannot wait to see where we go after this, both like from Obi-Wan's, you know, emotional recovery to what happens with Leia under Reva's care. That should certainly be an interesting dynamic as well. So we'll see, as Obi-Wan Kenobi already kicks off its back half. Now we're going to have to wait a full 7 days before it happens, but we're going to be back on Wednesday to talk it all through. Until then, I know we all have a lot of things that are going on in our respective planets when it comes to podcasts. LaTanya, how can people follow you on social media and check out everything that you are up to?
You can follow me on Twitter at LK Starks, where I will mostly for now be talking about Star Wars because it's going to be I guess not that far from when I, Grace Leader and I have a special post-show recaps thing coming out. So yeah, if you want updates on that, as well as any Star Wars thoughts that I might have when I am deciding to be on Twitter, you can follow me at LK Starks and figure all that out. Or you can follow me on, what is it called? Instagram at Stormborn1222, which is also my Twitch handle.
Amazing. And Rich, speaking of Twitch, I know you have been doing a lot on there, as you usually do.
Yeah, I live on Twitch over at twitch.tv/DMPhilly. You could catch me all the time running Dungeons & Dragons, other tabletop role-playing games. We did an awesome Star Wars one-shot at the beginning of the month, Mike, where I rolled out Reva as an NPC in our little adventure.
Yes.
And I think there's some great parallels to what I did there and what they're doing on the show. If I can pat myself on the back creatively for a moment,
do it.
I will. I am podcasting with the great Grace Lee later, but Under the Banner of Heaven, it's excellent. If you want a little teaser of her special project with LT, you should listen to the latest podcast of that. She reveals at the end what they're doing together. That sounds fun and exciting. And I am just delighted to get to sit down with you guys every week and to share, to hear your thoughts about Obi-Wan Kenobi here, because I'm a little bit confused and don't know what to think. So I appreciate the feedback from you guys. That's it. Yeah, go find me out there on the internet.
You're like Anakin, right? You just need one person to tell you how to feel, and that's how the way the universe should work.
Yeah, will you be my Sheev Palpatine, Mike Bloom? Yeah.
always.
So you can follow me at A Mike Bloom Time. Maybe I have gone a little bit like wrinkly from all this lighting in this room that I've been sitting in doing all this podcasting with the usual stuff between like Lost and Barry, and including the new stuff. Josh Wigler and I have started to cover Stranger Things season 4. We did our premiere recap and a big general reactions to the first 7 episodes, and we're going to start getting into episodic recaps starting tomorrow, I believe, at the time this is being released. And I guess one of the bigger things happening is this weekend, The Boys, season 3, it drops its first 3 episodes. If you thought Darth Vader snapping a child's neck was like, oh, this is dark and this is interesting, The Boys might be for you, because it is very evocative of that, but in my opinion, incredibly well done. So we're going to be doing coverage of that each and every episode. The first 3 episodes are dropping at the same time, it seems. So we'll be doing one episode on the day all of them drop on Friday. Then I think we're doing one on Sunday and Tuesday as well, spacing it out before it becomes Friday again and we start again with episode 4. So you can check all that out in addition to all the other fantastic stuff going on post-show recaps. I know that I believe coverage of The Time Traveler's Wife just got started. We're going to be ramping up coverage of Westworld again, now that show is coming back for the first time in a hot second. Speaking of modified robotic people, got plenty of those there. So if you're interested in that and much more, check out what's happening at post-show recaps. We are recording this on June 1st, which is the beginning of a brand new month, which is usually when we plug people to go check out our patron program. If you have the means to do so, postshowrecaps.com/patron. There are so many things that you can check out. Of course, you get extra podcasts, some podcasts early as well in a special podcast feed. You get access to the aforementioned Discord, where there are so many things happening, including a very lively Star Wars chat that starts the day that these episodes drop and just keep going and going throughout the course of the next 6 days. In addition to all the other fantastic things that are being talked about, a new season of Brant Steele just started, where they did an entire fan fiction of a Brant Steele season. So if any of that is your speed, postshowrecaps.com/patron. We appreciate any and all credits you may be lending to us right now. So that being said, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Again, feedback, StarWars@PostShowRecaps.com. You can go to PostShowRecaps.com/StarWars to rate and review us as well. That is greatly appreciated, as we are still early in the season, even though half of the season has still happened. We would love to get any sort of feedback and with your thoughts to the series, to the franchise, to the freaking awesome return of Darth Vader. And we'll see how much that return affects things moving forward starting next week. Thank you all so much for listening. May the Force be with you.
A long time to go. Go.